And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're sharing two fun interviews from the morning show archives today. The first with Dr. Marty Grothy, talking about his lovely book, Vive la Repartee, a look at insults and retorts from some of history's most skilled wordsmiths. In part two, a lighthearted look at the dynamics between mothers and daughters. Here's part one. Maybe you remember an interview which I did well over a year ago now with Dr. Marty Grothy about a very entertaining and interesting book called Oxymoronica, which took an interesting, discerning look at the oxymoron and the many ways in which that has appeared in human speech and writing and so on, and the different ways in which that could be used as a very effective rhetorical device. Dr. Marty Grothy is now back with a new book published by HarperCollins called Vive la Repartee, Clever Comebacks and Witty Retorts from History's Great Wits and Wordsmiths. Dr. Grothy is a psychologist, marriage counselor, speaker, author several times over, and you can also visit a website, www.vivelarepartee.com. We'll spell that a little later, and you can learn even more about this wonderful book. Dr. Marty Grothy, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's nice to be back.
Terrific idea for a book. Can you point to anything in particular that inspired this idea?
Well, as you know from our previous conversation, I've been a word and language and quotation lover for many, many, many years. I grew up in North Dakota, and back in high school was inspired by a high school guidance counselor who actually loved quotations. And so I got the bug, and this has just been my passion for years and years and years and years. To get to this book, last year my Oxymoronica book, thanks in part to you and others who liked it, did really well. And so the publisher said, well, is there anything else that you want to think about doing fairly quickly so we can still kind of jump on the success of the Oxymoronica book? And as luck would have it, I went into my what I called my great replies file, and that was filled with thousands of quotes that I'd collected over the last three or four decades. And I said, wow, I think this actually could be kind of fun.
Absolutely. Yeah. I appreciate how at some point in the introduction you give us a little bit of history of the term retort and help us maybe have a little richer sense of just what that word means to us now and maybe a bit of what it has meant in the past.
Yes. Well, there's a whole language of repartee that includes words like retort and riposte and rejoinder and so forth and so on. But the word retort is a fascinating word in and of itself. I mean, we know that what a retort is. A retort is a, I guess I would call it a verbal counterpunch against someone who's taken the first blow. And usually that first blow is some kind of critical remark. And in a good retort, which the Oxford English Dictionary defines as a sharp or incisive reply, especially one in which the first speaker's words are used against themselves, what happens is that a retort turns the tables on an adversary or an opponent. And people have been fascinated by retorts for many, many, many centuries, and I would guess half of your listeners out there are familiar with, perhaps the most famous of all time from Winston Churchill. At a party one night, Lady Astor, who he sparred with frequently, got annoyed and said, "Winston, if you were my husband, I'd put poison in your coffee." And of course, he famously retorted, "And Nancy, if you were my wife, I would drink it." I mean, that's a perfect example. I mean, one person has said something of a critical nature to another person, and instead of getting all flustered or annoyed or whatever, the person remains calm, cool, and collected, and then uses their wit to turn the tables on the other person.
You call it at one point a verbal counterpunch, which I think is a nice way to put it.
Well, and that's exactly what it is. And we see many of these in human history. I've got a chapter on political repartee, and there's a wonderful old story that's told about what's his name? Daniel Webster of Massachusetts, you know, the famous orator, and he's serving in Congress, and when he arrives there, he meets Henry Clay of Kentucky, a southern guy from down south, who actually they kind of develop a little bit of a friendship. And so one day, Webster and Clay are seated on the front porch of a hotel in Washington, and a man driving a pack of mules passes by right in front of them, Webster, you know, sensing an opportunity here to kind of take a little jab at his southern colleague, says, Clay, there go a number of your Kentucky constituents. Well, this is a perfect put-down, right? It calls for a retort, but what's he going to say? So Clay looks at the scene in front of him, and he says, yeah, they must be going up to Massachusetts to teach school. I mean, so we see these clever remarks. They've gone on for many, many, many centuries. And, I was surprised, honest to goodness, Greg, to discover that as I was putting together the book, no publisher in history had ever put together a collection of these great comebacks and retorts. There were a few little, 80-page efforts that were done 25, 30 years ago, but nobody had ever done it, so I was delighted to kind of fill a void here by, not only putting together great retorts, but the stories behind them.
Right. Well, and of course, you've already pointed out that there is something especially notable about being able to do this. I mean, it's one thing to see a situation and concoct some kind of put-down in your mind, but then to be able to turn on a dime as the recipient of that put-down and reflect something back. I mean, that is a far greater accomplishment than the first little transaction.
There's no question. And I think the reason why throughout history people admire these great retorts and these great replies is they know that in a similar situation they would have not fared nearly so well. In fact, the French have had an expression for a couple of hundred years. It was authored by the famous French writer Denis Diderot. The French word is esprit d'escalier, but it translates as the wit of the staircase. And what that means is that every now and then we think of a clever reply, but it's like an hour too late, and we think about it as we're descending the staircase on the way out of the event.
We start thinking of the things we wish we had thought of in the moment.
Absolutely.
Right.
And, Mark Twain once said, repartee is something we think of 24 hours too late.
I'm also reminded of all the times when one of my favorite writers, Judith Martin, also known as Miss Manners.
Oh, indeed.
So
yes.
Many times in her columns, someone will be writing her and saying something about how, I'm a person in a wheelchair, or I'm a receptionist at a big company, or I'm a whatever. And what they ultimately want more than anything is some kind of clever retort or repartee for those moments when people say something insensitive or even downright hostile. And it sort of speaks to our hunger to be able to do this at that moment when life kind of folds in on us in unpleasant ways.
Well, absolutely. These are little moments of truth. And we hope that during those moments of truth, we won't crumble and we'll somehow rise to a heroic level. And for most of us, it is kind of a dream. I mean, I did a book signing the other night in Raleigh, North Carolina. We now live down there. And, somebody in the room said, well, what's the best retort you've ever offered? And I said, that's a really good question, because I didn't have an answer. And so, I fall into that category. I mean, I'm an admirer of great wit, but I would not ever consider myself one.
Hmm. So you find yourself bowing before the greatness of others in this respect.
Indeed. And, talking about the greatness of others, I mean, the thing that's really fascinating to me is that some of the best replies in human history have not come from great wits, like Churchill or Twain or Groucho Marx or W.C. Fields. They have come from people like you and me. There's a great story about Muhammad Ali. Did you recall reading that one in the book?
Oh, I think so. Go ahead, tell our listeners.
Here's Muhammad Ali, this colorful character. In the 1970s, I mean, he was the best-known athlete in the world, noted for his verbal dexterity as well as his physical skills. He's He's on an airline flight from Boston to Miami, Eastern Airlines. As the plane's about to take off, he's in the first class compartment with his entourage. The flight attendant walks down the aisle, and she notices that Ali's seatbelt is not fastened. So she says, "Mr. Ali, would you please button your seatbelt?" with a sense of firmness. And, of course, Ali, the ever-playful guy that he was, looks up at the flight attendant, and he says, "Superman don't need no seatbelt." And, of course, all the members of the entourage, you know, giggle and laugh at their clever, you know, friend. And the flight attendant looks Ali straight in the eye and, after a little pause, says, "Superman don't need no airplane neither." Well, I mean,
yes.
You know, put yourself in this situation. Here's just a regular average flight attendant. You know, she's got to be somewhat thrilled and also maybe a little intimidated by the fact that the heavyweight champion of the world is in her first class compartment. You know, he challenges her with this comment, which would probably deflate just anybody else, but somehow she kept her cool, you know, just like Winston Churchill kept his cool, and she came up with the perfect remark.
Yeah, no kidding. One of my favorite chapters, I think, in the book is titled Laconic Repartee.
Oh, yes.
And you remind us of a word we don't use enough and don't practice enough in our lives, Spartan.
Yeah.
And the fact that sometimes these great comebacks and retorts, repartees, whatever form they might take, that some of the most effective and most memorable are the ones that are also the most succinct.
Indeed, indeed. Well, again, just for your listeners who may not be completely familiar with some of these terms, you know, most people know what the word Spartan means. You know, that means to be economical in our goods and our possessions. But there's another word to Spartan, and that's the word laconic. And Laconia was actually the capital of the ancient nation-state of Sparta. And to be laconic means also to be economical in the use of our words. And so today when we say a person is laconic, we say that they're a person of very few words. And so some of the best retorts, I've got a chapter called Laconic Repartee. And I would say some of the best replies in human history are one word or two words in length. And I think a great one comes again from our friend Winston Churchill. In the 1930s, he was at a social gathering with a number of friends, you know, men and women.
Yes.
And they were talking about the future, and there was a kind of a sort of a liberated woman of the time, a feminist, if you will, in the group. And at one point, she stands up and she says, "By the year 2100, women will rule the world." And, you know, everybody listens to her for a moment, and there's a sort of a pause in the group, and all of a sudden Churchill says, "Still?"
Yes.
I mean, it was the perfect one-word reply.
I think my favorite from this chapter is actually pianist Oscar Levant.
Oh, go ahead. Do you want to go ahead and you tell that one?
Got right in front of me, but he's at a dinner party and sitting next to a lady who's talking and talking and talking and talking and talking. You say it was kind of one of those captive audience situations.
Yeah.
And Levant's trying to look interested, but in the middle of one of these long expositions about something, he can't help but stifle a yawn, and she looks and with kind of mock indignation says, "Am I keeping you up?" And Levant replies, "I wish."
I know. Isn't that a beauty?
So all of these are essentially one- and two-word retorts and repartees.
Yeah. Remember Pope John the 23rd?
Yes.
We've seen a few popes now in the last 50 years, not a whole lot of them, but, you know, we don't normally think of popes as having a great sense of humor. But Pope John the 23rd was one of these rare guys who did have one. And I remember when he was actually serving as the pontiff when this story began to be circulated. Apparently some reporter one time was interviewing him, and he said to the Pope, "How many people work in the Vatican?" And the Pope thought about this for a second, and then he said, "About half." So, I mean, you don't expect that kind of wit from, a pope, do you?
No, not at all. There's something very nicely economical about that.
Indeed.
One thing that's interesting, too, is that there is a, although the vast majority of these we are talking about verbal exchanges, you would devote an entire chapter to the written repartee. This is interesting, and it seems to me that when written repartee kind of leaps off the page, that's sort of a special accomplishment unto itself.
Oh, indeed. Well, you know, when most people think of repartee, they think of these verbal duels. But, you know, in fact, I would say some of the best examples of great replies have come either in letters or telegrams. I didn't even know about that when I started working on the book. I had one or two examples, but they began to pile up. And so all of a sudden, a whole new chapter, you know, on written repartee just kind of emerged. And I don't know what your favorite is, but I know what mine is.
Go ahead.
And this, again, involves Winston Churchill. I hate to keep going back to him, but, you know, he's
the master. He was a master, yeah.
He is the master. Well, you know, in the early years of the 1900s, he and George Bernard Shaw had a fairly contentious relationship because here was Churchill, the kind of rising star of the conservatives, and here was Shaw on the other side of the political continuum. He was a founding member of the Fabian Society and a practicing socialist. And so at one point, just before the opening of Shaw's 1913 play Pygmalion, and of course your listeners know that Pygmalion was the play that inspired My Fair Lady, right? It introduced Henry Higgins and Eliza Doolittle. So Shaw sends Churchill a telegram just before the premiere event. He says in the telegram, "Reserving two tickets for you for my premiere performance. Come and bring a friend if you have one." Well, this was just a perfect opportunity for Churchill. You know, most of us would have thought a month about what to say. Churchill fires off a telegram to Shaw in reply, and he says, "Impossible to be present for the first performance. Will attend the second, if there is one." I mean, brilliant stuff. And of course, another one from that chapter, just to quickly mention it, is in the 1960s, Cary Grant was acting with all of the great Hollywood actresses of the time, but it was clear that he was like 30 years at least, or maybe even 40 years older than some of them. Cary Grant debuted, his first film in America was in 1932 with Mae West. But in the 1960s, here's this dapper, suave, debonair guy, but nobody knew how old he was. So apparently one day a magazine was doing an article on Grant, and they sent Grant's agent a telegram. And, you know, in telegrams, you know, there was always this kind of interesting, they called it telegraphies. It was the way in which language was used in telegrams.
Right.
And so the telegram said, "How old Cary Grant? ? Well, Grant apparently was at his agent's office when the telegram arrived, so he sent the reply. And his reply said, "Old Cary Grant, fine. How you?"
Very good. Well, my favorite is from Forbes' Book of Great Business Letters.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
oh,
love
yeah.
This.
This is a clever one.
Yeah, the executive editor at Monocle Periodicals in New York City sent his publisher a telegram that read, "Must have raise or count me out." The publisher replied with this telegram, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah, that kind of said it all, didn't it?
Yeah. You know, it's too bad an especially delicious chapter that I wish we had time to talk about is a whole chapter devoted to inadvertent repartee.
Oh.
And I remember when we talked about oxymoronica, some of the best oxymorons or surprising puns or whatever are the ones that kind of come out and surprise us. And you also devote a chapter to risque repartee, in the world of sports, the world of politics. I mean, this just comes from everywhere in life. And it must have been so fun for you to put this together.
You know, I don't think I've ever had more fun working on a book. So I really appreciate your interest in it, and I thank you for the interview.
Vive la Repartee, Clever Comebacks and Ritty Retorts from History's Great Wits and Wordsmiths, published by HarperCollins. Dr. Marty Grothy, the author. Dr. Grothy, great to talk with you again. Best wishes.
And the same to you, Greg. Take care.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Well, over the last couple of nights, I have really been enjoying a book which I think could be of tremendous help to many, many people. The book is called You're Wearing That? Understanding Mothers and Daughters in Conversation. Perhaps you know Deborah Tannen's previous best-selling book, You Just Don't Understand, which also explores this whole topic of how people talk with one another and the almost limitless ways in which we manage to misunderstand what each other means. And there are some very special and to some extent unique ways in which that occurs between mothers and daughters, even mothers and daughters who very much love one another but don't always know how to talk with one another. The book is published by Random House, and we are going to be talking with Deborah Tannen about this book and how she has come to understand all that she does about this very interesting topic. Deborah Tannen, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here.
Looking forward to talking with you very much. I think one of the things that I really feel like asking you right off the bat is just how unique the dynamics are between mother and daughter, in the sense that I think once upon a time, we thought about men and women in very compartmentalized sort of fashion, or at least that's the assumption we make. And of course, a lot of those lines have blurred a bit over time. And it isn't the father who's the breadwinner. It isn't the mother who cooks all the meals and so on. I mean, the lines have blurred in all kinds of ways. Have they not blurred in this respect, or does the way we communicate, does it still have rather unique colors and shapes depending on whether or not it's mothers and daughters or fathers and sons and so on?
You know, that's such a good question. When I wrote You Just Don't Understand, there was kind of a feeling, well, now we have so much equality, these things shouldn't be coming up. And, of course, a lot has changed. In many ways, women and men are the same. And yet these patterns still existed by which we frequently misunderstand each other. And I'd say the same is true for mothers and daughters. In a way, mothers, and this is about adult daughters, mothers and daughters are like friends. I don't think that was the case in the past. But that doesn't mean that they don't often approach conversations from different perspectives. And in fact, all the aspects of women's conversation that come up in women's friendships are there with mothers and daughters, but more intense perhaps because of the intensity of the relationship, how much time they spend together, how important they are in each other's lives. So absolutely, much of what I say in the book is true also of fathers and sons, fathers and daughters, mothers and sons. And yet I kept encountering a level of complexity and intensity with mothers and daughters that really wasn't there with the others. Very interesting when you talk to women who have both daughters and sons, and they'll say, it's just totally different with my daughter. Talking to her, it's the best and the worst. Sometimes it's like walking on eggshells. Women tell me they talk more to their daughters. They expect to talk more to their daughters. That's not surprising. I found when I studied women and men, girls and women, as distinguished from boys and men, negotiate the relationship through talk. Your best friend is the one you tell everything to. Whereas for boys and men, often the best friend is the one you do everything with, or the person you can turn to if you need him, though you may not talk to him for quite a while. And so all this talk, and often talk about personal topics, makes mothers and daughters particularly close, but it also means there's more opportunity to say the wrong thing. And the negotiation of how close or distant we are is another thing that I found of girls and women. big preoccupation of are we the same, are we different, cherishing the way you're the same, but really don't wanting to be too the same because you want to still be independent and recognize ways you're different. It's a constant negotiation with mothers and daughters as well. We kind of look to each other as representatives of ourselves, look for ourselves in each other.
Before
and
we dig...
Maybe just one little last point here. And another thing that seems to come up more with daughters than with sons, the feeling that daughters have that their mothers are criticizing their appearance. So, you know, I call it the big three, clothing, hair, and weight, where the mothers are commenting, like, do you like your hair that long? Oh, your hair looks so beautiful when it's smoothed back, but saying it when it's not smoothed back, but falling forward. And that's a difference because women, more than men in our culture, are judged by appearance, and even more, the range from which we have to choose our styles of hair and dress are much broader. So the chances of choosing exactly the perfect style of hair and dress that could not be improved are actually pretty slim. And women often look at other women thinking she'd look better if her hair or her clothes were different, but we don't say it. But mothers feel that they're entitled or maybe even obligated to say it. That's their job, to help their daughters improve.
I love one story you tell about a woman who was telling her mother about some presentation she was going to be giving at work, and it was a really big deal and a very exciting thing, and the mother's first question was, what did you wear?
And isn't that wonderful? Sorry.
It's
so wonderful because if her friend had asked her that, she probably would have been pleased. The woman who told me that said, who cares what I wore? Well, she cared. Put a lot of effort into deciding what to wear. But when we hear it from our mothers, there's a feeling that she's focusing on our clothing or our hair instead of our accomplishment, because we so much want her to be approving and appreciating and valuing in ourselves, in valuing what we value in ourselves. I have heard so many funny stories. Daughters on television, she's present at a bill signing ceremony with the President of the United States, and her mother watches it, and when she talks, she says, you needed a haircut. Or the daughter's picture's in the paper, and the mother says, I see you didn't have time to cut your bangs. I have heard endless stories like this.
One of the things you mentioned in actually the preface of the book is that you have analyzed word-for-word transcriptions of conversations that were tape-recorded by students in some of your classes. Just tell us briefly a little bit about that.
Yes, I teach linguistics at Georgetown University, and my field is sociolinguistics, which is how we use language and social relationships. And our method is to record conversations, transcribe them, and study the transcript with, of course, the sound of it in our heads, because the sound of it is such an important part of the meaning. So as part of my classes, my students frequently record conversations and analyze them in papers, bring them into class, and kind of like workshop. So it's an opportunity to really hear moment to moment what gets said, and you can pin down when the trouble started. Because so often when, again, it can happen with anybody, but it often happens with mothers and daughters. You think you're having an amiable conversation, and then suddenly there's a tone of contention, and each thinks the other introduced that tone of contention. So one person thinks I made a simple, honest, innocent comment, and why does she suddenly get angry? And the other one is thinking, why did she say this threatening thing? So she is the one who started it. So if you can actually look at the transcript and pinpoint that, it's really thrilling to see it.
We're speaking with Deborah Tannen about her book, You're Wearing That? Understanding Mothers and Daughters in Conversation. Much of the book sets up kind of a scenario of, in the form of a dichotomy, that so often there is some kind of delicate balancing act going on between two things, and often maybe contradictory things or two sides of the same coin. And it's so interesting to think about this. I mean, for instance, that in a close mother-daughter relationship, what is the difference between involvement and invasion? and often in conversations, just the kind of problematic conversation you were just telling us about, in the turn of a phrase, a mother's involvement in their daughter's life starts to feel like something else.
Yes, there are so many of these examples where caring and criticizing are created by the same words, or a show of involvement can risk seeming overbearing. Just a couple, or critical, a couple of quick examples. A mother calls up her daughter and begins the conversation, "I miss you." Well, you say that to a friend, the friend would probably say, "Oh, I miss you too." It would be a positive thing. But in this case, the daughter said, "Why did you miss me? We just talked to each other a week ago." Well, her back was up because she heard the implication she should have called. And, of course, the meaning doesn't come only from the current conversation. It comes from all the ones you've had in the past. Very amusing to me when I heard the same conversation recounted to me by a mother and a daughter individually. Didn't talk to them together, but I talked to them separately. So, for example, one daughter commented to me, I heard from the mother first, and the mother said, "This is a typical example of I can't open my mouth, I make an innocent comment, and I don't know what I said to set her off." She said, there was a vegetarian at dinner, so we were all talking about vegetables, and I simply asked her, "What vegetables do you like?" And suddenly there's a flare-up. And she said, "Well, maybe," I said, "do you like vegetables?" Well, I talked to the daughter. The daughter said, "My mother is always telling me I don't give my kids enough vegetables." Okay, so this is the backstory. And she said, "Everybody was saying what vegetables they liked, and my mother said to me, 'Do you even like vegetables?'" Now, look how different that is, that little word, even. It's an assumption that you don't like vegetables, which grows out of the assumption you're not parenting well, which is so upsetting to daughters. Every mother worries she's not a good enough mother.
And now, in your book, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
In your book, you talk about meta messages, and I think you're giving us an example of one. But I want to make sure I understand what you mean by that term. But it sounds like the meaning which we assume somebody has in something that they're saying, on the surface it might be one thing, but underneath it is something else. Is that what you mean by a meta message?
Yes. Well, the message is the meaning of the words, and the meta message is the implications, what you understand about the relationship or what the person is trying to say, because they say that in that way at that time. It's not as if a meta message is something sneaky or should have been said directly. Every utterance has a message and a meta message. Now, if I say to you, "How are you?" you've got to know, am I asking for a health report? I might be if I know you've been sick, or is it just a greeting? So that would be the meta message. What am I trying to do by saying this?
Well, and it seems to me that because we just talked about how mothers and daughters can be so close, even when there's contentiousness, that sometimes when we feel close to someone, it seems to me we also maybe sometimes maybe overestimate our ability to see beneath the words of other people. I mean, we jump to conclusions that she said this, but what she really meant was this, or what I think she's really getting at is this. Well, maybe not. But when people are close, it seems to me we sometimes jump to those kind of conclusions, which can really complicate this whole matter of communication.
Yeah, well, you're right, because there's so much at stake. We may well misunderstand and misinterpret meta messages all the time, but the repercussions aren't so significant. But daughters want so much to feel that their mothers approve of them. Mothers want so much to feel that they're still helpful, still needed, that the possibility of overinterpretation is really great. And I point out, we often tend to underestimate our own power and overestimate the other's power. So another example, a daughter and her husband have bought a new apartment, and they feel the mother is critical, so they make sure to show her the apartment they've bought when it's beautifully furnished with the former tenant's furnishings. And the mother looks around, and she does say some nice things, and then she says, "They may have told you this was in move-in condition, but when they take those pictures off the wall, there are going to be holes." So the daughter and her husband felt the mother was really reaching for something to criticize. And I commented, well, maybe she's really reaching for some way she could be helpful. They don't need her anymore. They bought the apartment on their own without her advice. So isn't there some way that her greater experience in the world can be helpful to them? So maybe that's what she was reaching for. I think mothers often don't realize that what they say carries so much weight. They feel it's because they don't matter that their daughters don't want their advice. But often the daughter doesn't want their advice because they matter so much. What her mother says is really hard to ignore. I give an example of my own. Some years ago, my parents were celebrating their 65th anniversary, and my sisters and I made a party for them. And my mother had an idea that whenever you have an important occasion, you must buy a new dress. And I didn't share that, and I didn't really have time to go shopping. I tried. I went to some stores, couldn't find the right dress. Every time I spoke to her, my mother was asking, have you gotten a dress? And she was getting more upset that I wasn't doing what she obviously thought I should do. And I was getting more upset that I felt she was trying to control me and make me do something that I didn't think was necessary. So I did what many women do. I talked to all my friends and got courage, and they all reassured me it was fine to wear a dress I had that was appropriate and in good condition. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to be my own person and resist my mother's pressure and not buy a new dress. And I felt so much better. And then I went to one more store and bought a new dress. The feeling that I was going to disappoint my mother was very strong. And I think mothers, I'm sure that during that whole time, my mother was thinking, why don't I listen to her as if she's not important? I think she would have been amazed if she'd realized how strongly her words were influencing me.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thing, isn't it? And you talk about at one point in the book, the great power shift, where at some point in time, a mother really becomes less powerful as their daughters grow up, and the mother needs to deal with this. And yet at the same time, even as a daughter grows into adulthood and establishes her own life and her own abilities, she finds herself often still very much dependent on her mother's reassurance and encouragement. It just underscores how complicated we are. And that there are not, there's not a simple arc here, which allows this to sort of unfold in predictable patterns.
Well, that's absolutely true. So many women report, and again, men too, when you go home, quote home, go visit your parents in their home or your mother, you feel like you're 12 years old again. And it's funny, they always say 12. They don't say 8, and they don't say 15. I think there's something about 12 where you're just on the cusp of becoming an adult, but really not sure that you are an adult. And the feeling that you're dependent on your mother's opinion in itself makes you resentful. But yes, daughters have a lot of power. Often they're the ones who control how often they and their mothers will speak. If there are grandchildren whom the grandmother may adore, it's in the control of the daughter or the daughter-in-law how often she can see them. So all of these things mean a lot of power. So I think if we both, if we recognize our own power, we can perhaps wield it more cautiously. One thing that mothers, I heard from mothers of adult daughters and from daughters when they're being honest about themselves, we treat our mothers more callously than we would anybody else. Maybe we assume they're going to be there when we need them, and if our plans change, we just tell them, sorry, our plans changed. Women often will yell at their mothers much more than they will at their fathers. Women have told me they hang up on their mother, and then they think, oh, my goodness, I wouldn't hang up on anybody else. So there is a way that the mother is taken for granted. We expect everything of her, and I think that's often very common of women. We expect more of daughters than sons at the same time as well.
Yeah, you say that there are high expectations when it comes to mother-daughter relationships, and that's one reason why it's kind of a highly charged relationship, and we are so deeply disappointed when things go wrong. And also, of course, so often we don't even really know ourselves what it is we want or need at a given point in time. For instance, you talk about kind of the tricky trade-off between sympathy and advice. I mean, when we're sharing with our mothers, or we're sharing with our daughters, for that matter, some sort of problem or something, and what is it that we want? And, I mean, most of the time we really want sympathy. Sometimes we want advice. How do we know? How does the other person know? It becomes very tricky.
Yeah, that's so true. One of what I think of as the greatest hits from my book, You Just Didn't Understand, was the feeling so many women and men recognize that she may be talking about a problem and he wants to be helpful and offers some solution, and she gets annoyed. You know, I didn't want the solution. And he thinks, well, what are you telling me if you don't want to do anything about it? Well, it's very fascinating the form this takes with mothers and daughters. They may agree that it's good to just show sympathy, but sometimes the sympathy itself can be too much. Let me give you two examples, one where the daughter appreciated the mother compared to the father, and the other where she appreciated the father's style more. And both of these come from students in my classes. So in one case, the daughter had the flu, and she called home. And usually when she called home, she talked to her mother. And this, I find across the board, it's much more common for the daughter when she calls home to talk to the mother. But this time, her mother wasn't home, so she talked to her father. Oh, Daddy, I have the flu, and I feel so bad. And he said, well, take aspirin. And she said, I did, but it didn't really help. I still feel bad. And he said, we'll go to see the doctor. And she said, I tried, but I couldn't get an appointment because everybody's sick. And he said, well, I can't help you then. And she wrote that she felt let down. She was missing something. And then she realized her mother would have said, oh, you poor thing, I'm so sorry. I wish I was there to make you a cup of tea. I'll call back later, see if you feel better. So she missed that expression of concern. But now here's another one. A young woman broke up with her boyfriend. So she was talking to her friends and her parents. She said normally she spoke more to her friends, but she really wanted her parents' view on this. And she said her father gave her his perspective, and she appreciated it, and then he never brought it up again. Now, that could be seen as a failure of concern, like the father who said, well, I can't help you then. But in this case, the mother's concern actually made it worse. So every time she talked to her mother brought it up. Hmm. How are you doing? How's he doing? Have you met anybody else interesting? Has he met anybody else? What are you doing Saturday night? So she finally had to say to her mother, please stop bringing it up. That makes it harder. And her mother was hurt, and she really didn't want to hurt her mother's feelings. And she said that made her realize why she prefers to discuss things with her friends than her mother.
Huh.
And, of course, that's one of the worst things that any woman can feel from her friends or her daughter or mother is being left out.
Right.
Girls really fear that. Girls punish each other by leaving them out. So if I don't tell you what's going on, that means I'm keeping you at arm's length.
Hmm. Something else, too, is that that struck me as a point that really does seem more uniquely applicable to women than to men. You talk about how women really prize indirect communication. They love the idea of being so close to someone that you don't have to spell out every single thing, and that men, when we communicate, don't tend to get into that kind of communicative pattern. But that because there is this sense sometimes of that of indirect kind of communication, and it goes without saying, well, then sometimes important things end up getting unsaid, and some misunderstandings really ensue.
Yes, so often our strengths and our weaknesses are two sides of the same coin. And it really came to light when I was talking to one woman who told me first how special her relationship with her daughter was. And she said, she knows me better than anybody. She senses my moods instantly. When I can fool everybody else, I can't fool her. If I'm feeling bad and trying to hide it, she knows instantly. And I heard this, by the way, from so many mothers and daughters, both ways. I know her mood instantly. If she feels bad, I feel bad. If she's happy, I feel happy. But then later in the same conversation, that woman said, it is so frustrating when my mother wants me to do things, but she won't tell me. She wants me to read her mind. For example, she was about to take her mother to the airport. And as they got in the car, her mother said, rather bitterly annoyed, grumpy, had to carry my own suitcase to the car. and the daughter knew, first of all, it was indirect, but she knew that she was being taken to task. So she said, well, why didn't you tell me that your suitcase was ready? And the mother said, well, you must have heard me coming down the stairs, and you knew I was getting ready to leave. And the daughter said, how could I know I was in the shower? So, you know, they ended up in an argument. But the very thing that she so treasured in her daughter, she was resenting when her mother wanted the same thing. You should understand without my telling you. We can all understand that. You think about a birthday present. You don't want to say what you want because then you would lose the payoff that the person understands you and knows you well enough and cares to do something about it. So it's another facet of this aspect that women are always tend to, and again, it's not unique to women, but we tend to focus on how close and distant are we, and is the closeness and distance that I want the same as the one that you want? And when there are differences there, that's when you can end up with one feeling left out and the other feeling encroached on.
We need to mention to our listeners that in your book you also offer hope, lots of help, lots of suggestions for mothers and daughters improving this aspect of their lives.
Yes, and I am amazed by how many women already are telling me how much it's helped them. The advice I give to mothers is realize that any help can come across as criticism and bite your tongue unless it's utterly necessary, maybe a matter of health. But also to daughters, just remind yourself that it isn't only criticism, it's also caring. So you're really both right. So one woman told me this already helped. It transformed a relationship. Every time she went home, she said they would end up fighting, and this time they didn't. For example, and I asked her for an example, and she said, well, she had bought two pairs of socks, one black, one navy. And when she showed her mother, no, fine, the next day she was wearing one pair of socks, and her mother said, are you sure you're not wearing one of each color? And the daughter told me in the past that would have set her off. But this time she just reminded herself, who else is going to care about the color of my socks?
That's,
you know,
good.
It's kind of touching.
Absolutely. Just another way to look at it. And as you say in that chapter, there are all kinds of ways in which we can change the script, and sometimes just lightening up and seeing the humor in things is the very best way to handle these potentially difficult moments.
Obviously, there's lots more advice that I give, but can't go through all of it here.
Absolutely. A beautifully written book, and by the way, dedicated to our author's mother. And many of those stories are very much here as well in this book called You're Wearing That, Understanding Mothers and Daughters in Conversation, published by Random House. Deborah Tannen, I thoroughly enjoyed this book and enjoyed talking with you today about it in the morning show. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Sam Kelly talking about his brand new book, Human History on Drugs, an utterly scandalous but entirely truthful look at history under the influence. And it is a long list of people that he examines, from Alexander the Great to Andrew Jackson to Adolf Hitler and many, many others. William Shakespeare, even, is someone who did much of his work while under the influence. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Thursday's Morning Show will include a conversation with Christine Heiser from Root Pike Wynn, talking about the big native planting event coming up this Saturday at Washington Park in Kenosha. And on Friday, Deborah Karp from the University of Wisconsin Parkside. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our weather forecast calls for partly cloudy skies today, with a chance of some thunderstorms developing later this afternoon, with a high of 83 degrees. Overnight, showers and thunderstorms are possible, even likely at certain points, with an overnight low of 56. Tomorrow's high under variable cloudiness in the upper 60s, with again showers and thunderstorms possible. Less of a chance of rain on Thursday as our temperatures continue to cool. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha Racine.